This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, part four of our Tough Choices series. When government budgets are in fiscal distress, sometimes one of the first things to go is a commitment to environmental issues. Tight budgets are forcing state lawmakers to weigh clean air against safe streets. Tough Choices tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. By the end of the 1960s, many regarded rock and roll as a spent force. The Rolling Stones' free concert at Altamont left four people dead. The Beatles were breaking up, and drug overdoses took the lives of many musical icons. At that moment, a new sound arose in England that would, in various forms, stick around for decades. Anger, wailing guitars, outrageous attitudes, walls of amplifiers, and dark, menacing lyrics typified a sound that's been described as dinosaur steps in the forest. Heavy metal was born. Black Sabbath by the band of the same name, lead singer Ozzy Osbourne. Largely hated by parents and dismissed by critics, heavy metal has spawned countless bands. Concerts draw huge crowds around the world. Is this music or just noise? If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. If you think heavy metal has no socially redeeming values, or if you love it, join the conversation. 30 years of heavy metal history is collected in a new book called Sound of the Beast, The Complete Headbanging History of Heavy Metal. Joining us from our New York bureau is author and longtime metal fan Ian Christie. Good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be here. I wanted to say quickly that I started doing radio shows in upstate New York when I was about 14, and I used to play an hour of heavy metal, then stop and play All Things Considered tapes, and then go back for the next 2 hours.
And which part of your audience hated you?
I don't know. I think there's a lot more crossover there than most people think.
Now, we played that first tune, Black Sabbath, I guess the eponymous Black Sabbath, but
right.
You describe it in your book as really the seminal moment in heavy metal.
Yeah, I think, you know, when the rains, that song starts with some storm clouds and ringing bells. It kind of sets the tone for the 1970s. It basically announces the end of the kind of optimism that the 60s rock bands had. Black Sabbath was a very optimistic band, but they were always very pretty dire. You know, they had a lot of hope, but they also had a lot of realistic observations on the world.
Now,
mixed in with a lot of fire and brimstone, of course.
Was this an instant hit?
Yeah, it was. Black Sabbath had always been an underdog band, but that record was gold in America within the year. I mean, it really wasn't like a cult thing. They were as much a rock stars as Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple at the time.
Now, I was going to say, I mean, there were a lot of precursors to heavy metal, Led Zeppelin and, you know, Blue Cheer, and a lot of bands that had lots and lots of amplifiers and about three chords. What was it that made it different? But go ahead.
I think it was the fourth and fifth chords. And Black Sabbath kind of... they trained on the same European circuit that the Beatles did. They actually broke the Beatles' residency at the Star Club in Hamburg. You know, that's really the fabled proving ground for bands in the 1960s. Playing 6 hours a night, they took the blues to something, to a place that it had never been, and totally broke out of the blues framework. And then, like you're saying, with those amplifiers, it was then very soon after bands like Judas Priest that came along and took all that volume and carved it up into very intricate, amazing ways.
Now, were these follow-up bands like Judas Priest, they weren't just clones of Black Sabbath, were they?
Not at all. Judas Priest was very much in Black Sabbath's shadow. They shared a practice space early on, and both came from Birmingham, England, you know, at the time a pretty depressed industrial Midlands city in England. But by adding two guitars, Judas Priest were able to orchestrate their music in a way that really set them apart from the 60s altogether. And they were always a very, very modern band.
I'm fascinated looking at your book about the numbers of different subgenres that you've managed to locate in the 30 years of heavy metal. I'm just looking, happen to jump across the page to German speed metal. The German bands had the true grit of thrash metal, but retained a precise melodic edge that showed devotion to the unique traits of heavy metal songwriting. Add on a gonzo sense of dress and an undying pool of pro-metal energy, and these bands cemented the country's status as a haven for headbangers. And you go on to tout Kein Schlaf bis Deutschland, Assassin, Celtic Frost, Coroner, Death Row, and all of these other German, you know, you've got about two dozen of these subgenres.
I tried. That's why those are broken out into separate pages, so that I can get away with sentences like that. You know, if that's a little bit too confusing, well, refer to page 144, and you get a kind of basic one page overview of what thrash metal is. There are subgenres that proliferated because I mean this there aren't so many books about heavy metal, and there's always been a generation gap. I think heavy metal's been seen as greasy kid stuff for so long. That has always been put on the back burner, maybe by publishing and, you know, definitely by the culture at large. But, I mean, at this point, you're talking about, like, 500 million records sold and millions and hundreds of millions of fans who have gone in and out of this stuff at some point in their lives. So,
our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our first caller on this subject is Amanda, who's with us from Buffalo, New York.
Hi.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I teach music in Buffalo, and I actually always tell my students that in music history, the people that are remembered are the people that do things new and different and that break the rules. And I think that heavy metal is just one example of that, and that sometimes the people that do things that are totally non-traditional are the most important in music history.
I wish that I had just said that. I think that's basically the premise that I undertook, you know. These guys really went out on a limb, especially during the 1970s. There was no circuit. It's not like you could, call up your booking agent and get booked at the large arena. There was basically not really a precedent for professional touring, which meant you had to be played on the radio. Bands like Judas Priest and Black Sabbath weren't getting played on the radio. They had to go out and, kind of take it on the cuff.
I grew up when all these guys were big. You know, all of my high school friends I can remember listening to this all the time. So,
and it's kind of, doesn't it feel like a vindication that, I mean, you know, 25, 30 years later, people are still listening and interested in Black Sabbath?
Yeah, and that new artists and groups are coming forward with things that replicate that style and that genre.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
One last question before you go, Amanda.
Okay.
Do you still listen?
I have to be honest, I have so many musical tastes that I can't say that that's the one that I listen to most frequently, but I do on occasion.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and we appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Go ahead, Ian.
Amanda makes a great point that really, Black Sabbath were the heavy metal of 1970. Heavy metal has changed so much over the years. All the subgenres are basically 2 to 3 year periods where metal adapted or was adapted by the young people of the time, or the most adventurous musicians, to become a sound that reflected the anxieties and the real concerns of the time, and also the technology that, you know, bands today are able to put things together on computer that would almost be impossible to physically play.
It was more than just the sound, though. It was the look, the presentation, and I was fascinated. In the back of your book, you have a group of heavy metal medical students, dreadlock pioneers, but also weirdest metal stage tricks, and this was fascinating to me. Inflating thick rubber hot water bottle by mouth, Thor, bodybuilder vocalist. Two was scraping bloody knuckles on cheese grater attached to guitar, Don Costa, M80, Ozzy Osbourne bassist. And three was wearing inverted KFC chicken tub overhead, Buckethead, the Guns N' Roses guitarist.
Yeah, actually, Thor, I think, ties for first place with himself for also bending steel bars in his teeth on stage.
We're speaking with Ian Christie. His new book is Sound of the Beast, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's get another call. John joins us from Everett, Massachusetts.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Hi, good.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, I'm a big, old school sort of 80s metal fan, and I really think that there's, you know, at least for me personally, there was, you know, there was a lot of soul in the music, a lot of soul and passion, and I really see almost a thread in my love of sort of 60s soul music and 80s heavy metal. I mean, I really feel that there's sort of you know the true bands seem to be playing with a lot of heart and a lot of soul and giving it everything they got in the same way that a lot of the great soul singers of the time were doing that as well.
Do you see it as a sort of a post-industrial outlook on life, Ian?
Oh yeah, very much so. It takes a little pieces from history where it suits heavy metal's needs, but a band like Metallica, a band like Slayer, they'll take lyrics from the Bible, history books, but it really all is about the music and the it's basically something that is very divorced from history in some ways, but has so many tendrils going out to things that still fascinate people.
Hmm. John, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, let's go now to Bob, who's with us from Guilford, Connecticut.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Bob.
You made a comment or a question, I guess it was, about whether we thought heavy metal was noise or music, and I know when I was growing up, I'm 52, when I was growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, I loved Black Sabbath. I don't find their music as enduring now as, for instance, the Stones or the Beatles' music. Is it music? You have musicians, you have instruments, and what I liked then, I don't like now. I find it more noise. But at the time when I was younger, it held something for me, and it was definitely an influence on my musical taste at the time.
And what do you listen to now mostly, Bob?
I listen to classical guitar more, a lot of the Stones, a lot of rock and roll, soul music. But for some reason, the heavy metal just didn't stick with me.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That's another point, I guess, about the genre boxes in the book. That heavy metal is such a big... It's endured for three decades now. There are a lot of people who liked the stuff in the 60s who then who could not stomach what was happening in the 1980s when things got very fast and very aggressive. And a lot of fans from the 80s that then can't stomach the infusion of rap into metal in the late 90s. It's funny that there are generation, as much as heavy metal has always been, had its own generation gap problem, there are generation gaps within the scene and within the world of heavy metal.
Here's a email we got from Kanya Summerlin in Kansas City. I'm a 30-year-old classical musician. One of the most revealing moments of my musical life is hearing of my viola flute-playing friend getting AC/DC and Beethoven tapes at the same time. Hearing my fellow eighth grader recount the look on the clerk's face still resounds in my head. Yes, heavy metal is music. It's not too far-fetched to compare Black Sabbath to Xenakis or Steve Reich.
Right.
Well, it might be far-fetched, I don't know. is there a legacy? I mean, does it hold up over time? And you talked about the sort of the collapse of rock and roll at the end of the 60s. Does the popularization of Ozzy Osbourne signal the demise of heavy metal?
Oh, I think Ozzy Osbourne has been more of a mascot than really an artistic leader for a long time in heavy metal. And you've got to realize that all these millions of people that were listening to Ozzy didn't, they weren't attracted by the bat head biting incident. There was always this colorful character there who was who people wanted to know more about and wanted to listen to.
And at the same time, this rebel, said his presentation to the Queen was one of the great moments of his life.
Right. Well, because he lived long enough to remember being a penniless street urchin when she was coronated, and his father took him down to the parade route 50 years ago.
Ian Christie, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
Ian Christie is the author of the new book, Sound of the Beast, The Complete Headbangers History of Heavy Metal, and he was with us from our bureau in New York. And ending our program today is Napalm Death, a heavy metal band fitting into the category of grindcore. And here's a bit of their song, Hung. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.